Lawsuits fly over transgender access to public school bathrooms. More testimony set for today in the sinking of the El Faro. And Jacksonville just keeps growing. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Make sure to catch the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show now video on demand with our partners TVJax.com, MetroJacksonville.com. And just ahead, all the news of the week with our Friday roundtable. Get on the line right now at 549-2937. Then later, it's a free workshop on a hot topic in the community, LGBTQ policy, access to bathrooms, so much more. That's coming up at UNF. We'll tell you all about it. Then later, a preview of the historic Springfield Tour of Homes this weekend. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday, and that means it's time for the weekly media roundtable. One of the most popular shows every week here today, Paula Horvath of the Florida Times Union.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to see you. Our own WJCT reporter, Ryan Bankin, today.
Good morning.
Fred Matthews of The Examiner.
Good morning, Melissa.
Hey, Fred, and Claire Goforth, editor at Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
So good to have you all with us. Plenty of news to go over from that testimony on the El Faro sinking that's been going on in Jacksonville to Jacksonville seeing a lot more growth and much more. But first this hour, lawsuits are flying when it comes to transgender bathrooms in our local schools. This has become an issue in both Clay and Duval counties, as Duval County faces a lawsuit over accommodating transgender students' bathroom access. At the same time, Clay County Superintendent Charlie Van Zandt Jr. says he will not comply in his district with the Obama administration's directive under Title IX to make sure that transgender students in public schools can use the bathroom of the gender they identify as. We want your thoughts and comments on this and all the news of the week. Get on the line now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet us, weigh in on our Facebook page. Paula Horvath, let's begin with you. Two very different approaches in Clay and Duval counties on this topic.
Well, interestingly, yes, two very different approaches. In Duval County, you had our superintendent saying, yes, he will comply with Obama's directive to open up the bathrooms to transgender students. And in Clay County, Charlie Van Zandt, the superintendent down there, has said that, he will not follow Obama's directive. But yet, in both cases, we have had lawsuits now filed against what those two superintendents have said.
Right. And Fred Matthews, what are your thoughts about State Attorney candidate Wes White helping to file the lawsuit here in Duval County over the issue of bathroom access?
Well, it's just another indication as to why we need to get President Obama out of office. He's done it again. He stirred up a hornet's nest on these issues. It just is never ending. As to what these are going to come down to. I mean, who's going to make the decision? What judge is going to make the decision? Is this a federal lawsuit that they're filing? Is it local lawsuit that's filing? And who's the judge that's going to decide it? All of this stuff is going to roll well past this fall's elections.
Claire Goforth.
Yes, I think that I disagree with you, Fred. I think that the president in this case is trying to lead from the front on the issue and do the right thing. Everybody who is opposed to allowing transgender students to use the bathroom of their choice is talking about safety. But the reality is that transgender students are the ones at most risk when they are forced to use the bathrooms that do not comply with their gender identity. When we try to stop them from doing so, what we're trying to do is to continue to criminalize behavior that's already criminal. Assaults are criminal, so no matter what, that's not going to change. What we're going to do if we force transgender students to use the bathroom that doesn't conform with their gender identity is really increase the risk of them being assaulted or worse.
And we'll go to your calls on this in a moment at 549-2937. Ryan Bank, this whole debate and conversation that's happening all over the country, if nothing else, it's introducing a huge swath of Americans to transgender people.
Well, I mean, I think the whole point of the directive really is, or the whole reason why the directive was put in place is because of this newfound understanding that most of the country has for who transgender people are and the issues that they face. I was saying a little bit earlier in the green room that this is almost very reminiscent of what happened in the late 60s in California when they tried to ensure that openly gay teachers could be teaching at public schools. And we saw this huge backlash, and it was sort of playing politics with almost a non-issue. In Duval County, it's really a non-issue. They've already been complying with this directive. So it's not like they're doing anything new.
Yeah, you know, when we interviewed Nico Laiviti, the Duval superintendent, on this program the other day, Paula, his response to all this, this was before the lawsuit was filed, by the way, but his response was, well, we've been doing this for years anyway, with no incident. So what do you think about Ryan's comment that whenever there's a big social change like this, there's an inevitable backlash?
I think that's exactly true. And I think it's important that people have a conversation about this. This is, conversation and through discussion is the way that things change. It's the way people come to an understanding of things that they may not agree with or things that they don't understand. So I think this is starting the discussion, and that's important.
And Fred, a moment ago, you made the comment that you felt that perhaps the president had pushed too far on this.
I don't think he's pushing too far. What I was indicating to you that he's put it on the table by making this directive from Washington. Again, it's one of those things, one of those progressive acts that the president has done consistently in his administration. And he's forcing forcing this conversation across the country. He knows, and certainly his Justice Department knows, that particularly the South, the East, places like Oklahoma, all those, they're going to push back against this. But it is the thing to do, and is nothing going to come of it. One of the lawsuits we have here, a young lady who was interviewed on TV the other day, says that she's filing the lawsuit because she's afraid that her daughter could get attacked in the bathroom by somebody who's masquerading as a female but is actually a male predator and could be in the bathroom with her daughter. So she's filing a lawsuit against this thing. So it is forcing the conversation, however uncomfortable it is.
Paula.
Well, interestingly, it is forcing the conversation, and there have been no incidences in which trans folks have attacked people in bathrooms.
That's correct.
That's a moot point.
Well, and the most interesting thing about it is that right now we're seeing the majority of people masquerading as trans people and going to bathrooms are people trying to make a political point on the other side of the issue. We've seen this with Target when they came out and in favor of upholding the trans identity. And I think it's also important to say that Obama's directive can have and is having in the Southeast this backlash against it. But at the same time, it's also mobilizing Democratic voters who I think are less than enthused about what their likely choice is in November. So I don't know if it's exactly a political calculation, but I wouldn't be surprised if it is.
Claire.
You know, Fred makes a good point about the president taking greater and greater powers, increasing the powers of the executive branch. And that's a very valid conversation to have. It's a trend that's been ongoing for many years. Bush was really, George Bush II, he did a lot in that area. But I think that, when is the right time to do the right thing? I think that you just always try to do the right thing. And President Obama is probably faced with a situation where we have a Congress who won't work together, who are just committed to stopping the political process and, showboating as much as possible. And, he only has a few months left. So why not take a stance on an important issue and make that part of his legacy?
Yeah. Presidents of both parties have a tendency to do these things as they're closing out their terms. Right, Fred?
The only other thing we're looking for is to see how many people he excuses from prison.
How many pardons.
How many pardons he gives before he leaves.
All right. Let's go to the jammed phone lines. Oh, boy. Let's begin with Autumn in Orange Park. Hi, Autumn.
Hi there. I just wanted to agree. I think it was Claire earlier made the excellent point that most of the people who are having acts of aggression against them in bathrooms are transgendered folks. And I'm so glad that this has been raised by Obama, because it's absolutely something that should have been dealt with years ago. And I'm so glad that we're doing it now. It's embarrassing that so many people are raising such an issue about it. It's especially when it's already been enacted in Duval County. Why are we just now, if it's such an issue and it's been happening since 2008, I believe Dr. V said, why are they now having a lawsuit about it? It's been happening for 6 or 8 years, pardon me. So why do we need a lawsuit about it now?
It's just, yeah.
I'm embarrassed about that, but okay. I'm glad that it's a rule now.
Thanks, thank Autumn. You. Paula?
That's exactly right. The point she makes about the trans folk being the people who are actually the receiving the assaults in the bathroom. There was just an assault yesterday in Washington, D.C., in which a trans woman went into a grocery store bathroom and was assaulted by the security guard who tried to drag her out of the bathroom. He was charged with assault.
Chris at the beaches, what are your thoughts, Chris?
Yeah, hi, Melissa. I just wanted to say I've been listening to NPR all week on this issue, and yours is the only show on which I have heard any reasonable voices all week, starting
thanks.
With Nikolai Vidi on Monday and with your panel today. And we've heard what this is not about. We know this is not about security for reasons already discussed. We know it's not about privacy because bathroom doors or bathroom stalls have doors and locker rooms have bathrooms and stalls with doors. We know it's not about government overreach because it was actually the state of North Carolina that was overreaching on the community of Charlotte in the first place. And I need to be the one to say what this is really about, a small group of religious people thinking the First Amendment gives them the right to force their religious beliefs on other people. And it just simply isn't true. It might be true inside your own house, but it's absolutely not true in the marketplace. Now, this is important, especially now at this present time, because we've got an open seat for Congress. And I just wanted to call in and be the first to say, let's have Nikolai Vidi run for our congressional seat so that we don't have a fiasco like we had last night, where LGBT rights are, impressed upon again by a small minority.
What do you mean by last night, Chris? What do you mean by last night?
Oh, you might not have heard about the fiasco on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives, where a small number of Republicans were forced to change their vote after the roll call vote in order to, depress an amendment that would have disallowed discrimination against the LGBT community from federal contractors. That was actually the... That amendment lost by one vote. Votes were changed. This was sort of late night news last night. If we had a reasonable voice representing Duval, like we do with Nikolai Vidi in the superintendent's office, that vote might not have failed by one vote.
Okay, thanks for that. And the House Armed Service Committee approved an amendment by Representative Steve Russell by a vote of 33 to 29. This, as the caller said, and I'm just looking this morning here at news about this, that would roll back protections against anti-LGBT discrimination in the workplace for federal contractors. So that's what he's referring to.
Right. Well, that's why the Senate is there to make a decision on those. I think that same appropriations bill that has to do with a greater bit of military spending, funding, and pay is still got to go to the Senate for some discussion.
I think it's also interesting because I believe it's been the same day that this was voted down that the Senate unanimously confirmed the first openly gay head of the Army. And you're talking about two different bills dealing with the military and LGBT people, and you have all Republicans and all Democrats in the Senate voting to confirm someone who is openly gay, which, by the way, could not have happened had we not repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So it's like it's just interesting to see how far the House has drifted from the Senate when it comes to reasonable debate on issues.
Let's take one more call on this. It's Mark in Julington Creek. Hi, Mark. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Thank you, Melissa. I'd like to agree with Fred. And we do need to get Obama out of the office. How dare he try to make things fair and equal for all Americans? And to add on to what the other gentleman, your previous caller, was just saying, for those who are uneducated, if you look at the North Carolina bill, deep inside that bathroom bill is a restriction for businesses not allowing them to raise the minimum wage and limiting overtime hours. So the bathroom part of that bill is the shiny object that Republicans like to use to say, look over here while we sneak something else right by you.
All right, thanks, Mark. And let me be clear, as I'm reading a little bit more about last night's chaos on the House floor, Republicans were able to persuade a few members of their own party to block the amendment that was intended to protect lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people from discrimination. They were able to reject the amendment that would have barred federal contractors from getting government work if they discriminate against LGBT employees. I just hope I'm being clear on that. It's a little bit complicated.
It is complicated, yeah. But that's why amendments like that sneak through. Somebody forgot to tell somebody else about that amendment, which was on its way for passage. And that's why they had the chaos last night.
Okay. And we're going to move on and talk about other news and notes from the week. Lots of calls waiting on hold. We'll try to get you on as soon as we can at 549-2937. Now, we've been talking about our schools. In a message to supporters this week, Duval County School Board member Connie Hall says she will not run for re-election. We were talking about the superintendent a minute ago. Connie Hall has been at odds at times with Superintendent Ecole Iviti. There are some new faces and names popping up that want to represent on our Duval County School Board. Lots of politics going on there as well. Fred
well,
Matthews.
I tell you, this District 5 seat, and probably it's part of next door, has just been up in arms for, believe it or not, almost 20 years. The members in those seats, since Wendell Holmes and Samuel Nesbitt left the board, have just not been able to get it together. And this latest incarnation with board member Hall is just bizarre. The latest thing we get this week of something that actually happened some time ago, again, is that she was being followed out of the school board parking lot by some black car, some black SUV, possibly had a female in it that might have looked like Mr. Vitti's wife. And the security guards are looking at the tape, and the cops are looking, trying to determine who it was, and the Times Union is on it. I mean, it's just all bizarre, and nothing is being done for the districts that they represented. They're just as poor, just as segregated, and they're still lagging behind in grade point average and others in the district. Now, you can blame a lot of this on the superintendent. But the school board members who ran for office ran saying they would do something about this, and they haven't. And so it comes back to the superintendent. Why hasn't he done anything about it? Well, he has. You didn't agree with what he did. So now you're going to accuse him of all this other stuff. And, it just is ridiculous. Maybe the next person that goes into this seat behind Ms. Hall, she's endorsed somebody going out the door, former legislator, legislative aide. Maybe out of the four that are running, that are going to run for it this fall, maybe we'll see some sense out of that. Warren Jones, by the way,
Warren Jones, formerly the city council,
hat in the ring.
He's now running for school board. Claire Goforth, given Fred's remarks, you kind of have to question people wanting to be on the school board. But of course, we want good people on the school board.
We do, but all this how political it's become is really muddling the issues. We're talking about Ricky King, and we're talking about all kinds of things, but are we talking about the issues that Fred is raising, the schools that are failing, segregation in these schools, and just the gap in education that students across the district are receiving? Those are the serious issues that we should be focusing on, but instead we're looking at a person who was running, who had sent inappropriate text to a former student, and possibly the superintendent's wife following someone out of a parking lot. I mean, that just seems like a red herring.
I think this is really at its core is just an issue of another local race being sort of polluted with the same kind of politics that we see in Congress and that we see in our own state legislature. It's like there can be no political race now that is free of this kind of political infighting.
And speaking of which, we want to talk about some other local political races in a moment. We'll get to those in just a moment. But first, let's go to Dr. Williams in Riverside. Dr. Williams, yes. What's your first name?
Donna, good morning.
Hi, Donna.
Good morning. I love your show. I love your topic.
Thanks.
I love the discussion. And I want to say to the guest who spoke about the situation with Dr. Hall and all that bizarre stuff at the school board, I moved to Jacksonville from New Jersey, and in 1994, I've never seen such a bizarre school district, not just today, not just with the superintendent, Vidi. I can go through a list of superintendents and school board members, and the problems relevantly have been the same with the district, with the children, with the entire school population, that today, if you statistically look at the crime at the youngsters in this city, it's a reflection of the educational leadership in the schools. And something needs to be done, and perhaps I will run, because I'm going to be honest, it's a hot potato mess with the representation and the leadership taking ownership of themselves rather than the leader position that they went into, which is to change lives and educate youngsters for tomorrow. The status of the city, the crime rate of the city, everything that is happening in this great city of Jacksonville, it's a reflection of what the schools are producing. And I'm sorry to say, but something really drastic needs to be done in this city. And that is my comment for today.
Donna, thank you.
You know, these positions are unpaid, but I was looking at the Supervisor of Elections website earlier, and there's a lot of money being poured into these elections. And one of the things that I noted, and someone had sent this to me earlier in the week, Cheryl Grimes in April, she received, she's second in the money race. She's got $18,000 in her campaign fund right now. Of all the donations she received in April, only one was from someone who lived in Jacksonville. Some of these donations were coming from as far away as Tennessee. They're coming from companies that are in the business of making money off of schools, charter schools, and other companies like that. I mean, I think that people really need to start asking why this money is coming into our Duval school system.
Well, we want to talk about some other local races. There's been quite a bit of controversy in the last few weeks about closed primaries, and they were closed by nominal write-in candidates for our state attorney and public defender races, also that Clay County superintendent's race down in Clay. And some people are going so far as to switch parties so that they can have a say in these elections for Angela Corey, Matt Shirk, and Charlie Van Zandt, all seeking new terms. Because write-in candidates file at the last minute and close the primary, that means that only GOP primary voters will effectively decide these contests. What do you think about this trend? And there have been several attempts to change the rules with the state Supreme Court, Fred, and they have failed.
These are political shenanigans. Everybody who's an insider understands what's going on. It is basically to shut off, as was written about several times this week, roughly 96% of certainly African-American voters within the four-county area concerning both the state attorney's race and the public defender's race. And say what you want. Say that I didn't do it. Say that my campaign guy, that Kenny Lay from down in Fleming Island, is not my supporter, and I didn't tell him to go over there and do that, and my campaign manager didn't go to Tallahassee and file for him. Say what you want. The fact that the effect is still the same is that you close this off. You effectively, they're not going to be enough people that are going to cross over from Democrat to Republican to vote in August primary. Everybody understands that, because they'd have to cross right back to get back in on the presidential election in November. They're simply not going to do that. Everybody understands it. This is a way of making sure that only your folks get to vote for you. And this is the same carryover now. I'm not one way or the other on the tax bill, but it's the same carryover we have with this tax referendum that the mayor wants to pass. By putting it in August, you have a lower turnout, you have less interested electorate at that point in time, and you have a better chance of getting it passed.
Paula Horvath.
That's exactly right. I mean, as far as these closed elections, what you're doing essentially is disenfranchising half a million voters in Duval County. That's a huge number of people. And a lot of them are African-American. If you look at the affiliations of African-American voters, only about 4 to 5% of them are Republicans. So we're talking about a huge group being disenfranchised by this move.
Let's go to Rose in Riverside. Hi, Rose. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are, I very much agree with the person who was just speaking when you opened the mics to me as to the disenfranchisement, not only of African Americans, which I happen to be one, but also Democrats, which I also happen to be one. And I am really concerned as to what the leaders of Democrats in this area in Duval County and also of the NAACP are doing in order to confront the situation. Right. I just do not believe that it should be tolerated, and I would be reluctant that some gimmick would not be pulled if one were to change their party just to make a statement that would not be sufficient to make a change and then have some difficulty again trying to return to their original party.
Okay, thanks. That's thank you, Rose. Comment. Thank you. And Claire Goforth, I believe you wrote about this this week, that you people can get angry at the way the game's being played, but you also placed quite a bit of blame on the local Democratic Party. They haven't fielded any candidates.
Exactly. I don't think there's any good reason for them not to field a candidate, and I called them out on it, and I feel like they deserve to be called out on it. I took a risk, and I expected some blowback from a lot of people within the party, and to be honest, I was surprised by the overwhelming support that I got from people, including high-ranking Democrats in our local community who said, thank you for saying this. I'd completely agree. We need to fix the Democratic Party locally. There's no excuse why they can't field a candidate. And it just looks, from the outside looking in, it looks like they're utterly dysfunctional and they just can't do it.
Ryan Bank.
Well, I mean, the Florida Democratic Party has been a pretty anemic political group, political party for a while. But I think you can't solve the actual issue here just by solving closed primaries. We're really looking at electoral dysfunction that's almost designed to be dysfunctional. We're the only really industrialized democracy that has this kind of archaic way of voting. Instead of just saying, well, we're going to have a open election and any candidate of any type of political party, not just Republican and Democrats, can go run for a seat.
A more parliamentarian system.
Right. I don't understand why we are still having this this discussion. I mean, most of the candidates that we have nowadays that people have a choice of voting for aren't even really anyone's ideal candidate, even close to their ideal candidate. And we're seeing that from this local level all the way up to the presidential election.
You know, with the 2016 election, the basic two-party system has been shaken. When you think about the fact that Donald Trump has tapped into unrest on the right and in the center of this country, Bernie Sanders has emerged as a credible alternative. And he's not even until very recently a Democrat. But there have been real challenges to this, to the basic control of the two-party system this year. So I think it remains to be seen whether the parties can re-coalesce after what we've seen at the national level this year.
Well, Florida's just got to get some leadership back in place. Debbie Wasserman Schultz probably needs to, after she finishes the term this year, she probably needs to come back to Florida and wrangle this party back in shape, because it needs some kind of strong leader somewhere from top to bottom. Duval County's Democratic committee has simply given up. That's the only excuse for that. They've simply given up. We've got Democrats who've gotten elected, so some of them, just as Lake Ray did on the Republican side, probably needs to come in as leadership and move the ball forward. But if they have given up, which this is again indication that they have, they're never going to get anywhere. They're never going to be able to change the legislation that you're talking about, Ryan, because that kind of thing is done by the legislature, and we don't have anybody in power to move an amendment. So the party is anemic, and this is just part and parcel, just exhibit A of how bad it is for the Democrats in this community. They're just going to have to do. And this is the year, by the way, that they would also be electing new leadership. And the Democratic Party, Republican Party. I think the Republicans have already chosen their new executive committee chairman. So we'll see who the Democrats are going to put forth, who may have some kind of cojones to get this thing moving in this next round.
Hello. Okay. If you weren't tuning in, tune in now, because you never know what's going to be said on this program. Now, let's talk about a few other news and notes from the week. Today, a former El Faro captain and executives with the nonprofit that regulates ships appeared before a Coast Guard committee. It's been going on for days, investigating the sinking of the El Faro that killed 33 local crew members. Ryan Bank, you've been covering this.
Yeah, you know, it's it's actually with each day of testimony, it just sort of gets more and more depressing. And I can't imagine what it would feel like to be one of these family members witnessing this going on. Really, what we're seeing this round of hearings is just a more specific look at shortly before the El Faro's final voyage and during the final voyage. What we know now is that the programs that the El Faro relied on for its cargo loading, for tracking weather, for all of these different very, very important functions were woefully inadequate. You know, the other day we figured out through testimony that a weather program that the ship used called Bon Voyage is probably one of the most archaic things, understanding that we have cell phones now that we can track weather in real time. This program populates a data file with National Weather Service updates that happen every 2 to 3 hours and enhances it with their own tropical storm data, and then sends it as an email package to a captain who then has to open it up and load it into a program. I mean, I imagine this as almost like a pigeon carrying a giant floppy disk and dropping it on the deck of the ship. You know, I just don't understand. We're learning now that the information they get is around 10 hours old.
Yeah, well, I so appreciate you providing really gavel-to-gavel coverage for WJCTnews.org. So follow Ryan on Twitter for that. And finally, we want to note that Jacksonville is growing. According to new data from the U.S. Census Bureau, Jacksonville, the 12th most populous city in America and the 12th fastest growing. More people moving here. That's pretty neat.
More people to pay for our pension.
We need it.
And finally, it's our collection of strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous stories from the week around the state. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material for you. Here it is right now, only in Florida, the Tasty Treats edition. And only in Florida are alligators caught on camera showing their sweet tooth. Gators like turtles, birds, the occasional human limb, but one large gator with a sweet tooth was recently photographed sliding into a canal east of Fort Myers with a whole watermelon clamped in his jaws. You gotta see this. The image has been shared online thousands of times. Speaking of food cravings, only in Florida does a near-death experience cause one man to crave, yes, Taco Bell. 35-year-old Jake Booth, a retired Army veteran and former Collier County deputy, woke up from a 40-day medically induced coma, and his first words were a request for some Taco Bell.
Had him thinking outside the box.
I like Taco Bell.
Taco Bell heard about it and sent him a swag bag. And then 22 days after his request, when he could once again eat solid food, Jake got to chow down. You can go to the website wakethejake.com for more about this. Finally, only in Florida do lovers of beer create edible packaging. Those plastic six-pack rings are damaging to the environment, so Saltwater Brewery in Delray Beach, Florida has released edible six-pack rings. They're biodegradable and edible, made of barley and wheat ribbons. Mm. Animals can eat them if they come into contact with
pretzels
them.
Pretzels weren't available?
And thank you to our media panel, Claire Goforth, Fred Matthews, Ryan Bank, and Paula Horvath. Guys, ladies, have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
We'll be back in a moment.
I'm Rick Mullaney, director of the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University. Join me for WJCT's quarterly program, Policy Matters. On each installment, we look at how public policy affects our lives. Join the conversation as we speak with Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry and Greg Anderson, president of the Jacksonville City Council. That's on the next Policy Matters, Thursday morning at 9 on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Amy Robach, news anchor of ABC's Good Morning America, will be this year's afternoon keynote speaker at Girls' Day Out, September 17, 2016, Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Amy is also a breast cancer awareness advocate and author of My Breast Cancer Journey, From Fighter to Thriver. For more information or for tickets, log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout.
This is going to sound like I'm making it up, but what you're about to hear was actually part of producing a major motion picture.
The amount of fizz that comes out of Matilda's butt, you know, how explosive that egg is.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Angry Birds the movie, and how all that animation gets made. It's next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Does the Big Bang mark the beginning of the universe or the end of our scientific knowledge? I'm Ira Flatow. Sean Carroll takes the philosopher's chair on Science Friday when the physicist ponders the big picture questions of the cosmos and humanity. Plus, we'll track the hidden digital trail you leave behind when using your smartphone. All on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, in recent weeks, the rights and concerns of transgender Americans have been the subject of much discussion in this country. Here in our own area, controversy over access to transgender public school bathrooms is just one example. Now, a free workshop is coming up here in Jacksonville next week, looking at the breadth of identities that are associated with trans and gender nonconforming communities. There's a lot to discuss, everything from legal and policy issues, healthcare access, and more. We're pleased to welcome on the line right now Willie Wilkinson, an LGBTQ policy expert. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. And in studio, Deanna Iovino, a clinical counselor. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
They will be leading a workshop coming up Monday on the UNF campus. It's called Providing Equal Access for Transgender and Gender Nonconforming Populations. Willie, let's begin with you. This is a discussion topic that for many Americans is quite new. You, though, are a policy expert in this matter. So given that there's been so much discussion in our own community over access to school bathrooms and more, what are your hopes for people attending this conference, what they'll be able to learn?
Well, I think everything from understanding more about who we're talking about when we talk about this population and the impact of multiple forms of discrimination, and how to look at, you know, providing services so that everyone can participate comfortably, so that, you know, it's equal access for transgender and gender nonconforming individuals, as well as people who aren't transgender, and looking at creating policies, procedures, and systems, and positive interactions with folks.
Right. And Deanna, this is an opportunity for everyone from nurses to attorneys, social workers, anybody who might need to know about these legal issues and these workplace issues.
Yes, any service providers that work with the transgender population.
Yeah, and so tell us a little bit about how this will be broken down, and this is coming up Monday on the UNF campus.
It will. There will be a resource fair there with multiple organizations who work with the transgender community, and they'll be it will be from 8 to 9 and then from 1:15 to 2:15. The actual training is from 9 to 1:15.
And Willie, what's the training encompass?
Well, first of all, we'll talk about the various terms, identities, and concepts associated with this population, how to show respect, what's helpful to keep in mind in the interaction, and looking at systemic barriers, health disparities, healthcare access issues, legal issues that impact this population, and how to create trans-affirming systems.
And let's define that. Deanna, what's a trans-affirming system?
I'll let Willie answer that.
Okay. What does that mean? What does that mean?
I'm sorry if I'm using language that's not as accessible.
That's okay.
A lot of times people feel that when they're working with a client population and they're presented with a transgender individual, a lot of times people aren't prepared they're not sure how should they handle it. So, for instance, in terms of gender-specific settings, which is, you know, currently something I think that is challenging for the general public to understand, you know, how should we accommodate or how should we work with an individual who might be different in terms of their gender? And in terms of, creating a non-discriminatory environment, it's really about allowing someone to participate in accordance with how they identify their gender, which might be different from the sex that they were assigned at birth. And so, you know, looking at, well, if somebody is a male-to-female individual or a female-to-male individual, you know, how they, if they, this is the gender that they identify with, then they should go to the support group, you know, for instance, that is for that gender. And it's really about understanding that this is how somebody identifies and this is how, you know, their right to receive services in accordance with how they identify. Does that make sense?
Sure. And, you know, there's still so much confusion and outright fear about these issues and why people might embark on a journey of transitioning. Will you address some of those fears and misconceptions?
Absolutely. That's where training can be so helpful, because it's an opportunity to ask burning questions and to really engage in discussion. And, you know, they give people an opportunity to talk about those fears and concerns.
So people can come to this workshop to learn, to ask questions, and perhaps as well express disagreement with, this is a big social change, and it's frightening for many people. Deanna.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. We have many service providers I work with who want to help this population. They just don't know how.
They don't know how.
Right.
And so what are some best practices for doing that, Willie? Because this is a new arena for Americans of many stripes right now.
I think the first piece is understanding that trans people are human beings that deserve equal rights like everybody else. And I think sometimes that part gets lost in these conversations that we're currently having. People are afraid. And, you know, for instance, you know, the whole bathroom issue, people are worried, but there's actually been no incidents where somebody's been hurt in the bathroom because a transgender person, you know, is just doing what everyone else does in the bathroom. You know, so those kinds of things. So in terms of best practices, we're really looking at, you know, understanding the population, understanding how to respectful interactions, you know, how to provide, you know, equal access basically by just treating everybody the same, but also really handling it on a case-by-case basis when you have a transgender individual or gender nonconforming individual. You know, basically, you know, given that transgender folks are have the right to receive services in accordance with their gender identity, then looking at, well, how can we do that in terms of our facility? You know, what are the types of interactions that people are doing in, for instance, residential accommodations or gender-specific settings? You know, do people need to take a look at their mission statement and reevaluate it? You know, how do we collect data on this population? What questions do we ask? You know, so those are some of the issues that come up systemically for folks.
All right. With all of that said, this is a free workshop. It's coming at Monday, May 23rd, kicking off at 9 a.m. at the UNF Student Union Ballroom, providing equal access for transgender and gender nonconforming populations. Willie Wilkinson, Deanna Iovino, both leading this on Monday on the campus, and we thank you so much for giving us this preview. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And in a moment, a look ahead to this weekend's historic Springfield Tour of Homes. That's next.
Spend some time in the Square, an online venue for local artists. WJCT invites you to vote for your favorite submission. Vote now through the end of the month. To learn more about the Square and to place your vote, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
On the next Fresh Air,
we're going to declare a war on poverty.
A war on poverty.
That's right.
That's Bryan Cranston as President Lyndon Johnson in the HBO film version of Cranston's one-man Broadway show about LBJ, which won a Tony Award. Bryan Cranston on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
It seems like lots of people are squishy. You don't know where they stand because they don't know where they stand. That's why it's so strange when somebody, anybody, simply won't bend. On the next Snap Judgment, Man of Steel. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it's your chance to tour some of Jacksonville's most beautiful homes. The historic Springfield Home Tour is set for this weekend with some fun new twists. Christina Parrish with the Springfield Preservation and Revitalization Council, creator of Porch Fest in Springfield, joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having us.
And this is so exciting. It's a great opportunity for people to not only see these gorgeous historic homes, but hang out in a great neighborhood, too.
It is. This is our 38th annual Historic Springfield Tour of Homes, and we've added a couple of exciting new twists this year. We're incorporating art and music into the event. Not only do we have six beautiful homes that date from the late 1800s to a modern house that was built just 2 years ago, we also have a number of bars and restaurants that are doing specials and have live music on Saturday night after the tour. We also have artist Mac Truck, who's doing a brand new show on Saturday and Sunday in one of the homes that are on the tour.
Oh, I love Mac Truck's work. And that's exciting. And so people can get their tickets now, and then it's a walking tour. They just kind of check out the homes at their leisure, right?
That's right. They can get tickets online through our website and through Eventbrite, or they can get them on the day of the tour at 1601 North Main Street, which is our starting point. The tickets are good for either Saturday or Sunday. And yes, it's either a walking or driving tour. We also have a bike tour again this year with Lee Burdett of E2Ride Bike Tours. That's scheduled for Saturday. The forecast is not fantastic for Saturday afternoon.
Yeah.
We're hopeful, but if Saturday is a rain out, she'll be doing the bike tour on Sunday.
So tell us a little bit about these homes. I'm very curious to hear about.
This year we have probably a bigger variety than normal. We have a quadruplex that's just been renovated that was built in the 1920s. We have a bungalow that dates back to the 1800s that's gone through a number of changes, and the owners have a really interesting hen yard in the backyard. They're urban,
a few chickens.
Yes,
okay.
Urban hen keepers. We have a beautiful Queen Anne home that the owners participate in Comic-Cons, and so you'll see some unusual twists to their decorating.
Nice.
Gorgeous, gorgeous house. We have a new energy-efficient house that was built by Terrawise Homes and is a net-zero house that looks like an old house from the outside but very contemporary inside. And then I'm a little stressed this morning because my house is also on the tour
this
year.
Your house, yeah, and I knew you had moved into a new home, a beautiful historic home in Springfield. So you're on the tour too, huh? All right.
Yes, that's why I have my jeans and tennis shoes on this morning because I'll be moving furniture and cleaning the rest of the day.
What's it like to open your home up to people that kind of come by the hundreds? That's got to be an interesting experience.
We're looking forward to it. Like a lot of the people in Springfield who've renovated houses, we really have a lot of pride in our house, and the opportunity to show it to other people is pretty exciting.
And this raises funds for a great organization, SPAR.
It does.
Springfield Preservation Revitalization.
Yes, all the proceeds go to support SPAR and all of the other programs that we do during the year.
This is also, I think people that live in Springfield, like you, are very much a tribe, and there's a lot of pride and a lot of enthusiasm about living in this particular neighborhood. Why do you think that is?
Springfield is full of urban pioneers and all sorts of people. There had been a perception about Springfield in the past that it was a little Wild West.
Uh-huh.
And we're kind of the non-traditional historic district. We're very diverse. We have all income levels, people from all over the country. And somehow we all love to come together and work on things like the home tour and also socialize together. And you'll see that when you tour the homes, you'll see volunteers in all the houses who live in Springfield. We never have any trouble getting volunteers to come out because our residents just love our neighborhood and enjoy greeting people. One of the other great things about the tour is every year we end up adding a few new residents who people who've come on the tour maybe never saw Springfield before, fall in love with the energy and the community and the old or new houses, because we have both, and they start calling realtors right after the tour and then move in.
That's right, and I'm sure that'll happen again this time. So again, it's the 38th annual?
38th
wow.
annual.
That's fabulous. Historic Springfield Tour of Homes this Saturday and Sunday. You can buy tickets when you roll up to the neighborhood at the office on Main Street, or you can go online. The website is
www.sparcouncil.org, and the tickets are discounted until tomorrow morning.
Very nice. And as Christina said, you can see Christina's new house, the First Lady of Springfield herself. I'm coming now. Now that I know your house is on the tour, I'm going to be there with bells on.
I hope we'll see you. My house is going to be fun. We have some guys from Jacksonville Old Time Jam are going to be playing on the porch, and I think we have neighborhood kids serving up lemonade during the day. So.
Excellent, excellent. Let's hope for good weather for the Historic Springfield Tour of Homes this weekend. Christina Parrish, always great to see you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
Well, that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchuk. Look for the segment today on the Tour of Homes at our partner tvjax.com. And make sure to subscribe to the daily podcast at iTunes and Stitcher. Diane Reams up next with a look at the week's top national news stories. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.